You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hi, this is Jim Adams from Monster Attack, inviting you to join us every Monday night at 5 o'clock for an all-new episode of Monster Attack. For the last 7 years, we've been talking about these wonderful movies that we grew up with as monster kids. So join us every Monday at 5 p.m. right here on the ESO Network.
Good afternoon.
May we be of assistance, sir?
Yes, I'm looking for a podcast for someone who likes that 1960s headache music.
Don't these podcasters have atrocious taste?
Sir, may I recommend this podcast by Monkeying Around? I guarantee a migraine.
I never heard of Monkeying Around.
You never heard of Monkeying Around?
He's never heard of Monkeying Around.
What does Monkeying Around sound like? I'll take it.
He took it?
He took it.
Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar companion. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey everybody, welcome to Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We're going to 1961 for this week's episode. And a strange little film that this is going to be very similar to a couple of other films I've talked about this season, in that the reaction I had to this film as a kid when I first saw it and a few times after that is different than the reaction I have as an adult. So, and I guess that's going to be true for a lot of films that we talk about from time to time here, as our perspectives change, as our age changes. So let me tell you a little story about what led up to the impression I had of the film Conga. This was a consolidated effort between an American producer and a British film company. You've heard me talk about Anglo Amalgamated before. They were famous for producing low-budget sci-fi and horror films. And in their American releases, they had a deal set up with American International Pictures, AIP, who distributed this film to the United States. Conga appeared on a double feature here in the United States in 1961 with Master of the World, the Vincent Price film that we talked about 4 or 5 years ago. This was a film that was sort of considered a poor man's King Kong. In all honesty, I mean, it's probably the best way I can describe it. This goes back a little bit further to me when I first saw the original King Kong. Now, I was about 9 or 10 years old. I don't know specifically. It was right in that time period where I was about in the second or third grade, maybe the fourth grade, right around in that time period. I had been watching monster movies for a few years, but I was still pretty young and putting together my monster movie filmology. And when I saw the original King Kong, I mean, it is one that I was aware of, I knew about, been looking forward to seeing, and it finally came around on TV. Now, I'm trying to remember, and in all honesty, folks, it's a little vague, if I saw it on my monster movie matinee show, the first show that I started watching monster movies on, or if it was just on another channel, because, you know, King Kong was considered an all-time classic. So I believe it could have been on one of the network channels. All I remember is when I finally got to see the movie, it absolutely blew my mind. I was in love with that film, as I still am today. The original King Kong still is one of my all-time favorite big animal-type films. An absolute classic. With special effects by Willis O'Brien that will live forever. Even today, his stop motion animation is just unbelievable. The personality he brought into King Kong and those sort of things, were things that Ray Harryhausen learned a great deal from and brought into his stop motion animation, which is legendary as well. So I loved films about big animals. And several years after King Kong came out, and in a film that I saw probably about a year after I saw the original King Kong, Mighty Joe Young, which came out in 1949, also won me over. And we're going to talk about that film down the road. I'm trying to hustle up a restored version of that right now as we speak. Not to be confused with the remake that came out in the 90s, which I'm very ambivalent about. Anyway, I don't want to get off the track here. We are going to get to Konga, I promise you. So those two, King Kong and Mighty Joe Young, you know, really had me, you know, just excited about, you know, films about large gorillas. So here I am in like the second or third grade, and this British film comes across. And by this point, I had learned that some of the British films that I was exposed to were pretty good. And I learned to watch for them because they seemed to be, you know, made pretty well. I thought, wow. Now, at the time, I didn't realize the film was in color. That might have even made it even more special. But, you know, at the time, we had a black and white TV, so it didn't really matter what it was, color or not. But the trailer showed that it was a big gorilla. And I thought, wow, here's another King Kong-type movie. I can't wait to see this. And something that also added to it, you might remember when I talked about the film Horrors of the Black Museum, which was also produced by Herman Cohen, who produced this film. He's the American producer I was telling you about. When I saw that Michael Goff was the star in this, I got real excited because I became a fan of Michael Goff's work from Horror of the Black Museum, which is still one of his main signature films. And, of course, American audiences will remember him as playing Alfred in the Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher versions of Batman. And Michael Goff was only one of two actors who appeared in all four films. The other one was Pat Hingle, who played Commissioner Gordon in all of those films as well. So he was one that I really enjoyed watching over the years. He would show up on a lot of British television shows here and there that would make it over to the United States. And, of course, he would collaborate with Tim Burton later down the road on Sleepy Hollow, as well as Corpse Bride. And there was a couple of others I think he did with Burton. So he worked right up until his death in 2011. That got me going. As a kid, I was like, yeah, I'm going to like this movie. And, of course, when the movie showed, you know, I got really into it. It was a little talky for me as a kid. But once they got to the big gorilla stuff, I was hooked. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Now, and I watched it probably two or three more times while I was in elementary school and junior high and high school. And I can remember, you know, when I was in college, the film wasn't getting many showings when I was living in North Carolina. In fact, I don't recall seeing it on Sunrise Theater. I don't remember if it got any showings on CBS Late Night. It may have. I remember vividly, this I do remember vividly, wanting to know why nobody was showing this movie. So as a kid, I loved the film. I did, even though I thought it was a little talky in the beginning. You know, and it dealt with things that were, you know, maybe not so much over my head, but it was just like, come on, get to the gorilla. That's what I want to see. But I didn't see it much the North Carolina years. And I remember thinking, why don't they show this film? Finally got to see it. I guess it might have been all the way up into my VHS years where I had a chance to rent it on VHS and still sort of got a kick out of it a little bit. It was a lot different than I remembered as a kid because, in all honesty, I didn't remember a whole lot of the beginning of the movie. And we're going to talk about the storyline here in just a minute, and I'll go a little bit more into that. So let's take a look at some of the people before I carry on now with some of my impressions of Konga, with some of the people you're going to see. Of course, we just talked about Michael Goff. Let's talk about the director of the film is John Lamont. John Lamont was fairly well known for doing British television series like Sir Francis Drake and Sixpenny Corner. Here in the United States, he was also known for directing several episodes of the Errol Flynn Theater. But he will always be known pretty much by those of us who are monster kids and sci-fi kids as the director of this film, Conga. That is going to be his big signature film among us. Also playing the female lead in Conga is an actress by the name of Margot Johns. And Margot Johns plays Michael Goff's assistant. Now, I didn't appreciate the depth of her character as a kid when I first saw Conga the first few times that I saw it while I was in elementary school and junior high. But Margot's character, Margaret, was more than just an assistant. We sort of discovered that she was a lover, and she ends up being betrothed to Michael Goff's character, Charles Decker, later on in the film. But, she's like his main secretary and assistant. He's a research scientist. And we'll tell you a little bit more about that when we get into the storyline. But there is an interesting dynamic between the two, because this is going to turn into a mad scientist type film. And of course, Michael Goff is going to be our mad scientist. And it's going to deal with the kind of obsession in science that we saw with Dr. Frankenstein in some of the Hammer films, and even in some of the Universal films and some of their mad scientist films. So that's at the crux of the whole movie. These kind of horror films sort of fall into just a couple of categories, and one of them is mad scientist films, and you can easily put this in that. So that distinguishes it a little bit differently from King Kong and Mighty Joe Young, which more dealt with animals who naturally were gigantic in proportion. What we're going to see here is an animal by the name of Conga, who was created by this Professor Charles Decker. Not much else is known about Margot Johns. I mean, she lived a long, long life, passed away in 2009 at the age of 90, and did a little bit. The 60s would be her year, her years as an actress, and most of what she appeared in were British productions and a lot of British television. So as a kid and as a monster kid, this is really the only movie I remember her for. A lot of the films and television shows that she'd appeared in Great Britain didn't make it over here to the United States. Now, we have a younger group of kids that appear in this film because Charles Decker is also teaching science at a local university in London. The university is never identified, but it is a London-based university. And we find out that Charles Decker is a claimed botanist. And one of his students is named Bob, played by Jess Conrad. Interesting that Jess is not his real name, but he was born Gerald Arthur James and became a well-known stage actor, and then also appeared in many, many films as a result of his acclaim on stage. But he picked up the nickname Jess, or Jesse, named after the American outlaw Jesse James, because there was already an actor named Gerald James in Actors Equity. And then he changed his name to Jess Conrad. The same kind of deal that we've talked about with people like Michael J. Fox altering his name because there was another Michael Fox in Screen Actors Guild. Basically, the same rules applied in Actors Equity as well. He was a drama teacher, and he was also a fan of writer Joseph Conrad, and that's when he figured, okay, as a stage name, since I'm changing my first name, might as well change the whole thing. So he changed it to Jess Conrad, and had quite a career over the years. Jess is still with us. He's 87 years old, still living in London, England, and performed for many, many years, appearing on such TV series as Miss Marple and The Body in the Library. Much of his work is seen in Great Britain, and I would say that Conga may be one of the few movies that we had a chance to see him in over here in the United States. So he's going to have a familiar look to him because he had that look of the kind of people, as kids, that we saw in a lot of the teen movies. And in this, he plays, you know, a young college student who is got a big crush and is in love with our next female lead. And, you know, the long and short of this movie is it's only going to center around four or five main characters that we're going to talk about here. And the next one is Claire Gordon. And Claire Gordon plays a character by the name of Sandra. Sandra has caught the eye of Charles Decker. She is his favorite student. And it, as we find out, develops into a lot more than that, or at least in his eyes, it does. And he puts the moves on her. That's going to have a big effect on how this storyline plays out when we get to our storyline here in just a second. Claire lived a fairly long life. She passed away at the age of 74 back in 2015. We lost her 8 years ago. One of the more interesting things about her career was that it is rumored that she was the subject of singer Scott Walker's song, Archangel, which, you know, made a play over here in the United States. So if you go back and listen to Archangel, it's talking about Claire Gordon. I didn't know that as a kid at the time. But in addition to Conga, she was also well known for one other, what I would say, cult film named Beat Girl, which was a British teen film that came out and was released in the United States under the title Wild for Kicks. I don't remember that one per se. Somehow that one eluded me as a kid growing up. She did a lot of theater work, you know, and a lot of film work, and had a very good life. So these are going to be the main people that you're going to see in the film. There are going to be a couple other actors you may or may not recognize. Austin Trevor, who plays the dean of the college that we were talking about, that Charles Decker works for, Dean Foster. And then Jack Watson, who's probably going to be a little more familiar to American audiences because he appeared in several films and British dramas, and many of those dramas did come over here to the United States. So when you see Superintendent Brown, you're going to say, yeah, wait a minute, that guy looks very, very familiar. Most of the other people that we're going to see are going to be, you know, relegated pretty much to British television and films, and ones that we didn't have an opportunity to see much here in the United States. Now, as we said on and on, with streaming and everything sort of opening up on film markets, it's easier to see some of these older British television shows and films now than it was back when I was growing up. So these are basically the main people that you're going to see in this film. So let's get into the storyline of Conga. Now, it opens up with us seeing a small airplane, like a small little Piper Cub, something of that nature, just a little one-engine airplane. We're not sure where it is. In all honesty, it looks like California, but it's supposed to be Africa. Actually, it's supposed to be Uganda. And the plane blows up as it's making a crash landing. You hear that the engine is having issues and all of that. And then the news guy from London comes on and says that this plane that had Charles Decker on it crashed. And it's unknown what happened to he and the pilot. But it's assumed that they were both killed in the crash. But as it turns out, we've got a little passage of time effect that now takes us 1 year later, and we find out that he was alive. And he's coming back to Great Britain after this 1 year being lost in Uganda. We see him getting to the airport, being interviewed by the press, a small group of press that are there to meet him. And he talks about one of the discoveries that he has made when he was exposed and lost in the jungles of Uganda, of these plants that reach enormous size. And a way of also by studying these plants, he believes that he can make a connection between prehistoric plant life and human life. You know, in the 60s, especially in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, there was all this talk about the missing link, the thing that you know, linked modern man to prehistoric man and all of that. And so any hint of something that links up things in the evolutionary cycle were of interest to people during this time period. So they were trying to capitalize on that sort of thing. Well, Decker goes back to work for the university, and he draws the ire of the dean, again, played by Austin Trevor, who says he's a little upset with some of the things he told the press because his theories are so ludicrous. It makes the university look bad, puts him in a bad shape. But this is where we start seeing very early on Michael Goff's character of Charles Decker and how obsessed he is in proving his case. It's a classic example that we've seen in many of these films of a research scientist who believes like he's being looked down on by people that have more experience and more of a track record than he does. If you remember Horrors of the Black Museum, Michael Goff was a writer, a horror writer, and his obsession in that led him to do some horrible things and to have people killed and that sort of thing so that he would have crimes to write about. Michael Goff takes that same approach. And by the way, that was a film that was also produced by Herman Cohen. And that's why Cohen thought of Goff the minute he got the gig to do Conga, because he knew that Michael Goff could play that kind of character. And he does. He brings pretty much that same approach here to Charles Decker, that he allows his obsession to override his sensibility and to do things in the name of science that would be considered unheard of by others. So right off the bat, I mean, within the first 15 minutes of this movie, we see that there is going to be some intensity between Charles Decker and Dean Foster. They get into a horrible argument. Decker storms out, and we know now that Foster may be taking some kind of punitive action against Decker because of what he told the press. Well, Decker, of course, is reintroduced to Margaret, who's been waiting for the year for him, convinced that he would make it back. And that's where we get sort of the idea that Margaret has a little bit more involved with Charles than just being a loyal secretary and research assistant and that sort of thing. And we definitely see that develop very quickly here. Of course, Charles is using it to his advantage, and he lets Margaret in on what he's researching. A nice little poignant scene where he takes her into the big greenhouse that he has on his property for his other botanical studies. And he starts tearing out all of the flowers to the horror of Margaret, who says, I tended after those very carefully so that you could pick up where you left off. And he goes, nope, we're done with these. I've gotten all the information out of them I want. You've got to see these plants that I brought back from Uganda. They are incredible. And so he starts putting them all into the greenhouse. And to make a long story short, because I don't want to go through the whole film here, we find out these plants are incredible. They are carnivorous plants. We're talking like Venus flytrap, huge Venus flytraps, probably 3 feet across. If you're familiar with how a Venus flytrap looks, pitcher plants, things like that. All of those kind of carnivorous plants that eats insects and that sort of thing that we learned about in science class as kids. And, he feeds them big hunks of meat every day. So, we learned that these plants are incredible. And one of these plants that's not a carnivorous plant, but the leaves of one of these plants is something that Charles has discovered may be the key to taking what causes these plants to grow so large and injecting it into the bloodstream of living creatures, of living animals, and making them large as well. Well, Margaret is just flabbergasted by the theory. And of course, this is the kind of thing that Dean Foster thought was absolutely insane. But Margaret is going to stand by her man as he continues on with his experiments. So Charles, we have seen also in the very beginning of this film, when he was being interviewed at the airport by the press, has a baby chimpanzee that he has brought back from Uganda that he tells everybody he named Conga. and leaves it at that. But we find out that the conga is going to be the subject of Charles's experiments. And to prove to Margaret that his theories are sound, that he's on the right track, he makes a serum from the leaves of this plant we were talking about. It gives a small injection to conga, and almost instantaneously, within a matter of seconds, we see him grow to a full-grown chimpanzee. Now, again, this is a low-budget film. It was shot for £500,000, which makes it fairly low-budget. And so the effect they use on this, it's a cheap effect, but sort of, make the picture wave around and all that, sort of a little bit of a psychedelic type effect. The color helps with it, as we see the chimp grow up very quickly. It works pretty well. As a kid, I thought that was fine. It was every bit as good as some of the werewolf transformation effects that I had seen up until that point. So, they got enough bang for their buck on that one. So now all of a sudden, Conga is a full-grown chimpanzee. We see right after this that he's very intelligent. Margaret has him go up and get her some tea. Not only does he just bring down a teapot, he brings down a whole tray with the cups and everything. She's just flabbergasted at how intelligent he is. Well, as things work on and on and on, Charles finally goes the next step. And the next injection creates a full-grown gorilla. Yes, I don't. Now, the whole thing about going from a chimpanzee to a gorilla is never really addressed. I guess it's more a visual thing. And the story behind the gorilla is sort of interesting in itself. Cohen had had success with two other horror films for AIP. One was I Was a Teenage Werewolf. So they were going to call this I Was a Teenage Gorilla. Actually, that was the working title before they changed the name just to Conga. Also, Cohen paid RKO Pictures $25,000 for the rights to the name Kong so that he could sort of exploit the popularity of King Kong as well. Now, as far as the gorilla part of the movie, Cohen wanted to hire Steve Calvert. Steve was a well-known gorilla costumer, known for Bride of the Gorilla and Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla, two other films that Herman Cohen had produced. So he had some gorilla experience here. But Steve Calvert had retired from performing. So Cohen said, man, I've got to get a good gorilla for this. So he turned to another famous gorilla actor by the name of George Barrows. Name might be familiar to some of us because he appeared as a gorilla in several productions. But through some kind of snafu, it turned out that Cohen only hired Barrows' gorilla suit, not Barrows. So now Cohen's got this the gorilla suit, but no one to be in it. And so he turns to a cattle call. So he has this big audition cattle call for actors to appear inside the gorilla suit. The part ended up going to an actor named Paul Stockman, an unknown actor who ended up having a little bit of a career down the road. He appeared as a gorilla one other time and also did some other monster suits as well. But Paul Stockman tells the story about how he got the job. And he said that his agent called him and said that an American producer was looking for an actor who was 6 foot tall. And Paul says, well, I'm 6 foot tall, so I guess I need to go there. And he says he gets to the audition room, and there's 20 other people there, 20 other guys there who are at least 6 foot tall. And he thought, oh, my God, okay, well, this is going to be a crapshoot. He didn't know if he was going to get it or not. Well, Cohen came into the audition, and he says, the actor has to be exactly, and I mean exactly 6 feet tall. 6 foot one is no good, and 5 foot 11 won't do. It's got to be 6 feet because the gorilla suit that he had from George Barrows would fit only a 6 foot tall guy. So all of a sudden, a lot of the guys just, have to leave because they're not exactly 6 feet. Three guys were left, including Paul Stockman. He was one of them. And he said the guy that, or Cohen said the guy that they can wear the suit well, will be the guy who gets the job. You're going to have to wear the suit 6 to 8 hours a day. Well, Stockman said that the other two guys had blue eyes, and he has brown eyes. And he knew that, he said, you know, there's no such thing as a blue-eyed gorilla. So he felt pretty good that he was going to get the part, and he sure did. The gorilla in this is probably the weakest part of the whole movie. Although, I got to tell you, folks, the storyline in this is really crazy. It's a very, very simple sort of childish type script. I mean, I got to be honest with you. But as a kid, I love this stuff. So we've got now this full-grown gorilla. You know, again, we're not sure how Conga came to be a chimpanzee and turn into a full-grown gorilla, but that didn't really matter in low-budget horror films at this time period. And now, Decker is just so ecstatic at how well this is going. You got this 6-foot-tall gorilla now. Margaret is just stunned. Charles has got something else on his mind. I won't call it revenge, but he's got a bone to pick with the dean. And so we see later on that night, the dean is working in his office at a big window behind him. And all of a sudden, a gorilla bursts through this window and kills Dean Foster. This is what brings in Jack Watson's character, Superintendent Brown, to our attention, because he's investigating the murder, trying to figure out, what happened. Now, Mrs. Kenton, character actress, played by character actress Vonda Godsell, who was Dean Foster's assistant, mentions to Superintendent Brown that Decker and Foster had met that afternoon, and there had been some shouting, raising of voices. Sounded like it got a little ugly. So Brown calls in Decker, and during that interview, he says, you know, we understand that there was maybe an argument going on, and Decker sort of blows it off and says, no, we had an argument. Or you may call it an argument. I call it a discussion. He said, we had a difference of opinions, but before I left, we had it all settled. Well, that was an out-and-out lie, because we know that Decker just sort of stormed off, not satisfied with the discussion he had had with Foster, who absolutely poo-pooed his whole theory that he was pitching to the university. Charles basically stormed out saying, I'll just work on my own. So he had it in for Foster, but Brown is satisfied, and they go on. Now we see Decker has this big party one night. Of course, Margaret, is the hostess. He is also realized that he's losing Margaret, because he is so obsessed with his work. There's no time for her. And she mentions how unhappy she is with that situation. So he agrees to marry her. And that brings her right around. So again, we see that Charles is a very controlling, manipulative type of guy. This is what he's good at. So Margaret's, right there in line with him. But when she sees the headlines in the newspaper about Dean Foster being murdered, she confronts Charles with it. And he admits he had something to do with it. He admits that some people, might have to be sacrificed for the betterment of mankind. That kind of logic. Margaret is going to be true to the end, and she goes along with him on it. You can tell she's not happy, but she is so badly in love with Charles, she's just not going to risk, her upcoming marriage. Well, this big party now, getting back to that, I didn't want to get sidetracked there, is sort of in connection with them getting married. And at the party, Charles meets up with Professor Tagore, played by George Pastel, another longtime British character actor, not one that's going to be too familiar to American audiences. A lot of the work he did, again, like a lot of these other folks, was seen pretty much in Great Britain, but not in the United States. But Professor Tagore is doing similar research. And now we sort of discover that Charles intentionally invited him to that party, because he wanted to meet the guy. And while they're talking, Tagore says, maybe we ought to collaborate together. Well, Charles isn't going to do that. He's not going to, share his discovery with anyone else, because he says, well, I think I'm a little ahead of you in that, but I'd like to see your research. I'd like to see where you're at, and I'm more than welcome to comment on it and that sort of thing. And so later that night, at midnight, Tagore opens up his home to him and his lab. Charles sees just how far Tagore is, and you can tell he's getting a little irritated because Tagore is getting close, very close to where Charles is in his discovery, and Charles is afraid that maybe Tagore will jump the gun and beat him to the punch. And the next thing we know, Conga is there strangling Professor Tagore. So now we've got two deaths. This does not evade Margaret's attention. She sees the connection here. Now, the one weakness in the script is that as this gets worse and worse and worse, that the police don't see it either. They should. It's very, very obvious that if you look at the one commonality between the death of Dean Foster and the death of Professor Tagore, it's Charles Decker. But the police go on the assumption that it's some kind of crazed killer out there and trying to find him. Now we've got this other sub-story that works itself into the film that involves Charles and Sandra. Again, this is the gal played by Claire Gordon. He has definitely got the hots for her. She's a very attractive blonde gal. And, of course, Bob, our fellow played by Jess Conrad, Bob is madly in love with her as well. We've already been, seen where Bob is getting a little jealous of Charles because Sandra is starting to spend most of her time with Charles because she has plans to, when she goes, furthers her university career, she wants to get into research or something of that nature. And, she's using her experience assisting Charles Decker and helping her to meet those ends. Bob doesn't like that. Charles Decker takes the whole class on a field trip. They're out there looking for ferns and that sort of thing. They get rained out and end up in this ranger's shack. And Decker says, well, we might as well just scrub the mission, scrub this field trip. He has this van that he travels around. He says, get back to the van. I'm going to close up the ranger station, and then we'll head back to the university. Bob hangs back and has a confrontation with Charles. And he basically threatens him, says, leave Sandra alone. She doesn't feel that way about you, and I feel too strongly about her to see her being used by you. And he ends up scrapping it out with Decker and then coming to his senses. He's strangling, getting ready to strangle Charles Decker, and comes to his senses and goes, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me. And all that, and Decker goes, forget about it. Don't mention this to anyone. It doesn't do any of us either of us any good. If you say something about this happening, I'll just forget it. I'm not going to have you expelled. I should, but I'm not going to. And we'll just leave it at that because Decker doesn't want it to get out. What's going on with him and Sandra? Although up until this point, nothing has happened. Well, later on, the next night, Bob is heading out to a date with Sandra. He's got a little Vespa. He's getting on the Vespa and hears some noise in the woods nearby. Goes to investigate, and here comes Conga, and Bob is toast. And we know now that, if we had any suspicions about how active Charles was in this, we see Conga making his way back to the van before the police get there and heading back to the university. Margaret now is beside herself because she's seen all this. She's getting more and more, concerned about what's going on. And a few days later, when Sandra is over there in the greenhouse with Charles, working on some classes that, future classes or whatever, notes for the upcoming classes, I should say, Charles makes a move for her, makes a big, he's been hinting at it all along throughout the movie, but Sandra's just not paid much attention to it because she doesn't see him in that light. But now he's overt. He says, I want you. I love you. And he physically attacks her, and Margaret sees it. Charles doesn't know Margaret's there, but she sees it and absolutely flips out. And while Charles is attacking Sandra, Margaret runs back to the lab, gets a full syringe of the serum, and injects it into Conga. And all of a sudden, Conga becomes huge. Now we see the Conga that's big enough to destroy a house. Unfortunately, Margaret's in the way, and she's the first one that gets killed. He grabs her. He's destroying the lab that sets it on fire and throws, and he just basically picks up Margaret like a rag doll and disposes of her. And now he goes on the move. But let me tell you one thing that did happen that I haven't told you about, but you should know if you've seen this movie, where Charles had basically used hypnosis to get Conga to do his bidding. Margaret also puts Conga under hypnosis so that now he's supposed to follow her orders. And of course, her orders are to go get Charles because she's had it with him. But he kills Margaret, so he's acting on the premise that he just needs to take care of Charles. And he sees Charles attacking Sandra in the greenhouse, bursts through the glass roof, and grabs Charles. Now, one thing that happens to Sandra that never is we never get this loose end tied up in the movie. It's another part of the movie I didn't like as an adult. Sandra falls back where the carnivorous plants are. Her arm falls into one of the Venus flytraps. When we last see Sandra, her arm is stuck in there with a flytrap attacking it, which there's going to be some acidity burns to her arm because that's how flytraps, dissolve the protein and eat their prey. So Conga takes off with Charles. He's destroyed the greenhouse. The mansion's on fire. He makes his way into downtown London. And then we have your typical people running away from Conga, who is trying to get at them, destroying buildings. The army is called out. And very quickly, in about the last 15 minutes of the movie, Conga is killed. After he has thrown Charles to the pavement and killed him, and the army is able to shoot him very much like they did King Kong in King Kong. And the movie ends there. With Conga, this is one thing that's sort of surprised me a little bit in the way they ended this. When Conga dies, he shrinks back to being a chimpanzee. Again, it was sort of one of the weaknesses of the film because that shouldn't have been really connected with what was going on. Anyway, that didn't bother me as an adult. Little things bothered me. So what I was saying in the beginning about this is, as a kid, I really loved this movie, and I couldn't wait to see it whenever it was going to show. Unfortunately, it didn't show that much over the years, so it was a long time before I got to see it again. When I got to see it on VHS, it was like, wow, there's a lot about this movie that's a lot different than I remembered. Because mainly the big part of it when I saw it as a kid was, I just sort of forgot about all the stuff in the first 40-odd minutes of this film. I just wanted to get to the part where he started, where the gorilla gets loose and goes after Charles. That's really all I cared about. So as an adult, when I saw this on VHS, it was like, oh, it lost some of its luster. But when I saw it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, it had been the first time in about 20-some years. It was like, wow. Yeah, this is really sort of a weak film, isn't it? It's an interesting ride. It's got some problems. The gorilla effect is not good. Putting an inexperienced guy in the gorilla costume, which I didn't think the gorilla costume was that good looking, but Paul Stockman, God love him, they needed an experienced guy in the costume to make it a little more believable. That wasn't as noticeable to me as a kid, but it really stood out, these last few showings that I've seen it the last couple of times now in the last couple of weeks. It's a weak film, and the storytelling is very weak. It was definitely made as an exploitation film to capitalize on King Kong, so not a lot was put into the story itself. Herman Cohen was a big contributor to the screenplay. Again, he just wanted to get it out, get it shot, and get it into the theaters to make some money. I couldn't find any box office information on this, but I'm sure this made some money, down the road with the home video rights and that sort of thing. And this was released on DVD and is also available on Blu-ray, came out on Blu-ray in 2019 in a 2K print, which includes some special features that include the trailer, a gallery of pictures, and the radio spot that they used to advertise the movie. So the name of the movie is Conga, which also created a very successful series of comic books that came out from Charlton Comics. Remember Charlton Comics? They were good at doing stuff like this. And they had 23 episodes, or 23 issues, I should say, of Conga. And the series featured all kinds of what we might call kaiju monsters or big monsters. So that's well worth a look if you can get a hold of any one of those. Some of them might be a little hard to find, but they were all reprinted in 2013. They reprinted all the issues that Steve Ditko worked on, which would be Conga number 1, and then 3 through 15, and Conga's Revenge number 2. And there's also a deluxe hardcover collection called Ditko's Monsters Conga, which you can find. So that might be the best way to get a hold of the comic series. I'm going to be looking for the book, because I like to collect the hardcover ones. That's just the thing I sort of do. But they were very, very successful. So a lot of money was made off of that as well. But again, folks, I'm not going to, I never tell you not to watch a movie. This one, it's a quirky little film, but I would have to say, in all honesty, it was probably geared for young kids. You know, it really was. I think they'll have a blast with it, like I did. But as you get older, you start seeing the flaws and the storytelling and the makeup and that sort of thing. And it takes a lot of the luster out of it. But even as a kid, the few times I saw it then, it was like, okay, get over this talky stuff. Let's get to the gorilla stuff. That's what I want to see. So I really was only interested in like the last 20 minutes of the movie, even as a kid. I was willing to put up with the beginning of it. So as an adult, I had totally forgotten about the storyline of the beginning of this, about the Africa plane crash and his relationship with Margaret and all of that. Totally forgotten about it. But it's a quirky little film and a fun little film. I had one from my childhood that I remembered. I remembered the name Conga, and I remembered the images of Charles Decker being grabbed by Conga in the greenhouse and being taken to downtown London and all of those scenes. So it did have some staying power with me over the years. Anyway, Conga from 1961. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next week with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. It has been a fun 8th season, and we appreciate the way you guys have come back after our long break earlier in the year. Thank you so very much, and we hope to be around for many, many more years. As long as there's monster movies, there will always be Monster Attack. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Monday.
Soul Forge Podcast. It's a geeky look at love, life, fandom, mental health, pop culture, and so much more. If you're into learning about yourself and the universe, Soul Forge is your podcast. Each week, we have a surprising new topic, from stupid things we do for love to product reviews, and there's almost always a fun guest host. Like and subscribe to Soul Forge Podcast today.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.